Hello, and welcome to Around and About Chattanooga. I am your host, Michael Edward Miller, and today I'm speaking with the author of several award-winning environmental books. Janice Ray's newest book is called The Seed Underground, A Growing Revolution to Save Food. She's going to be here in Chattanooga talking about sustainable growing and heirloom seeds, and she's also got a memoir out, Ecology of a Cracker Childhood, that's very relevant to this area. Janice Ray, welcome to Around and About.
Hey, thanks. It's good to be here.
It's good to have you here. I want to start out talking about The Seed Underground, your newest work. It exposed something that I'd never really thought about before, which is kind of a paradox of modern life. On one hand, we are living in this era of unprecedented choice. If I wanted to grow, you know, flowers or vegetables in my garden in my yard, I could get on the internet and just get, you know, pretty much anything you could think of because there's so many places to buy seeds online. And yet your book says, in spite of all this choice, the actual diversity of seeds is shrinking. What's going on? Why is it shrinking in this era of plenty?
Well, that's a great question. And such a startling thought that we had more choice of what to plant in our gardens 100 years ago than we do now, or what to eat on our plates. The shrinkage is caused by a few things. Fewer of us live in rural areas and have gardens at all. At the turn of the century, you know, maybe 40-something percent of people were farmers, and now less than 2% of us are farmers. Most of us don't even have a plot of land to grow anything on. But I think the real cause of the decline of agrodiversity is the way we grow food. So, following the so-called Green Revolution, we were growing more monocultures on bigger pieces of land, and growing foods for commercial use, for shipability, for beauty on the supermarket shelves, and less for their taste or their nutrient content. So that's the biggest culprit there, is a sea change in, a cultural change in how we produce food.
And this isn't just idle speculation, the idea that having fewer and fewer farmers who save fewer and fewer seeds means less and less food diversity. In your book, you've actually got some scientific studies you're citing that really prove this. You've got some numbers that back this up.
Yes, let's talk about the numbers, the decline first. Two scientists at the University of Georgia did a study in 2005 in which they were looking at seeds available commercially 100 years before. And they found that there was a 94% decline in open pollinated seeds on the market. Now, there's a little paradox here, and that is there is actually a 94% decline in seeds in the last 100 years. But there's also, we have commercially available about the same number of seeds that we had before, which is strange because you think, well, where did all these new things come from? Well, some of them are introductions from other countries, like a new Ghanaian watermelon. Some of them are new plants, new breeds introduced by plant breeders. But the reality remains that vintage cabbages and collards and okras are disappearing and have disappeared. Some of the difference, like we have actually brought back some of these once thought lost vegetable varieties by plants people, you know, stalking the country, looking for old cantaloupes and melons and so forth, and then bringing them back on the market through the Seed Savers Exchange and through other small seed companies. So it's a very complicated issue, and but the fact is we're losing varieties of food, and the figures are about 94%.
And your book talks about some of the specific kinds of vegetables that you personally have encountered while trading seeds with people and being part of this seed saving movement. But more than just cool food to eat, tasty and interesting things that we probably haven't eaten before because they've been lost for so many years. You're saying this also has some serious environmental implications, the loss of seeds, the loss of diversity. Why does this matter from an environmental point of view?
Well, we know from conservation biology and from ecology that the less diverse any system, then the greater the potential for its collapse. That was shown to us in agriculture with the potato famine in Ireland in the mid-1800s, in which most Irish families were planting this one variety of potato called lumper. Prolific, an acre could feed a family, but it began to suffer from late blight. And so that led to widespread famine and diaspora of an entire people. It's not just an environmental impact, but also a cultural impact that, you know, could we perhaps go hungry if we limit the varieties that we grow in this country to a very few? So traditionally, we were growing hundreds of varieties of all kinds of vegetables and grains and fruits. And, you know, for example, the Appalachians have one of the highest agro-diversities of anywhere in the country, because up those hollers, there people would be growing a kind of bean that didn't grow anywhere else and would trade it among themselves up and down the road. But yet the next holler over, people were growing a different kind of bean. And it's just the danger of that loss that I think most about. Now, when we look at agriculture in general, we see that there are all kinds of environmental implications of industrial agriculture, and that goes from the detoxification of our food supply to, you know, eutrophication of waters and so many different things. So in general, I think that we need to eat, you know, more locally so that the food is fresher and more nutritious for our bodies. And I think we need to eat more organically so that we're protecting our own human health as well as environmental health. And I also think that we need to be knowledgeable about our seed supply, that, maybe we shouldn't patent all of life, and maybe we should take back control of some of our germplasm that's going to feed us into the future.
I'm speaking with Janice Ray. She's an environmental writer and activist who will be here in Chattanooga to give a talk on Thursday, July 24th. One of your earliest books is called Ecology of a Cracker Childhood. It's about growing up in South Georgia and the loss of the longleaf pine. And I think it's interesting because, you know, when you think of the woods, when you think of Georgia, or at least when I think of it, I think of beauty and nature and all that. But you say the place you grew up in was about as ugly as a place gets. Why would you say that?
Well, I think that the South Georgia and really the South in general, you know, following the Civil War, it's been really mined for its resources. And what was left was not only financial poverty, but also a kind of cultural poverty. And, you know, I look around and what the landscape that surrounds me is not that the grandeur of the Rocky Mountains of the West. But it's, you know, it's cut over pines, it's clear cuts and trailer parks, and not all. The South has beautiful places. Yesterday I was in a beautiful Cypress Lake in about an hour away, paddling. So, you know, it's not across the board that we've destroyed all beauty, but I do say that we have suffered, that our part of the country has suffered the losses of nature and wildness.
Your writing style itself, and I think particularly in Ecology of a Cracker Childhood, it's this really interesting mixture of very poetic language and description, as well as detailed memories of your life growing up there, plus, you know, more scientific environmental writing. How did you develop this style where you're kind of moving back and forth and melding between all these different genres of writing in one book itself?
I think what I'm trying to do there is to turn what could be a science a scientific literature or marginal literature and really and make it literature. The first writing that I ever did was poetry, and I realized that, you know, I may not be able to get my ideas across as widely as I'd like with poetry. So, you know, so few people read poetry. And yet it's very difficult when I'm writing narrative for me not to return to that, you know, the absolute love of language and, you know, the playing around with diction to make things meaningful on lots of levels. So I'm really purposefully trying to elevate just simply nature writing to a literature. And tons of people before me have done this, Thoreau and John Muir, you know, many people.
In the book, you talk about not only growing up in South Georgia, but specifically growing up in kind of a junkyard. Your parents had this junkyard where they would take old cars and things like that and collect them and sell them. And you have this one scene where you bring a boyfriend home for the first time, mm-hmm. and you're afraid he's going to be scared off. And he kind of is, actually. You say that he kind of stayed to himself and stayed in a bedroom the whole time and didn't really interact much. Was it a challenge for you growing up like that and then eventually saying, you know, I'm not ashamed of this. I want to write about this and tell the whole world this is who I am and this is where I come from.
So you're exactly right. And there's a chapter in the book called Shame. And, you know, the older I get, the more I realize like how much I have grappled with that, those feelings of being less than or having something that wasn't just standard middle class lifestyle. And but yet what it gave me was this story that was different from anybody else's story. And I realized that as a young writer that I could use, you know, I wanted to tell the story of the landscape, of the 99% loss of this ecosystem in the southeastern United States, the longleaf pine. But I could use the story of my childhood, which, you know, included the junkyard and mental illness and our own poverty and so forth. I could use that as a vehicle to tell what really is a much greater story, a much more important story. So I alternate back and forth. And what became increasingly clear is how the two things parallel, how the stories of our lives parallel, or especially here in South Georgia, parallel the story of the landscape.
In your latest book, The Seed Underground, you have a chapter about what people can actually do about this. What are just some practical tips and suggestions you have for the average person, maybe somebody who's not ready to make radical, drastic changes in their life, but wants to do something?
If a person has no yard at all to grow anything in and has no interest in putting open pollinated seeds in the ground, then I would say to think about what they eat, to try to eat more whole foods, try to cook for themselves so that they're, you know, thinking about what they buy, try to buy more locally, try to buy from farmers so that people understand who's growing their food and they can speak with the farmer to figure out what's being put on the food, what kind of seeds are being used. And beyond all that, you could also become a seed activist. There are libraries across the country that are putting in seed libraries where the patrons come in, check out a package of seeds, plant them, and return seeds at the end of the year. So it keeps these locally grown seeds evolving and adapting to specific places. Villages and towns all over America are passing ordinances that protect seeds and seed sovereignty and food varieties. So there's a page in the back of the book. The book is available at most libraries, and this page is what you can do. It just, you know, you don't have to garden to really think about what's happening to our food supply and wanting to preserve it for the future.
In your book, The Seed Underground, you're talking about the seed-saving movement, and something that really surprised me was where you talk about the fact that it's not necessarily always a perfectly unified movement where everyone is just getting along harmoniously. It seems like there are some issues, maybe even a little bit of drama sometimes. What are some of the issues in the seed saving movement? What are some of the things that people who maybe have the same goals don't necessarily agree about?
Well, some of us believe in using chemicals to grow, and some of us don't. And some of us don't mind others, you know, growing our food for us, and some of us want to provide for ourselves as much as possible. Let me just think here what some others are being. Are you thinking about one in particular?
I'm thinking about the seed bank, where it sounded like some people weren't happy that seeds were being sent to that seed bank in, I think, Norway.
Yes, so that is a very complicated issue, but you're exactly right. There's a group of seed savers that believe that the best way to preserve seeds is called in situ, which is in place. That means growing in gardens, and Gary Nabhan is one of these. He believes that gardens are living gene banks, and so in people's gardens, the seeds have a chance to adapt to microclimates and the changing conditions that we're seeing as the climate disruption continues. And then there are others who think that, no, we just need to sock these seeds away in government germplasm banks or in Svalbard, which is the big global seed bank in Norway. And the danger there is in, you know, widespread destruction of the seed bank itself, where everything gets wiped out at once, and also that we don't have the evolution that you would have with seeds growing. I want to say one more. There's another reason why we need seeds out in people's hands, and that is because people trade them, and for the best viability, you know, for a seed to be really healthy, I think we need to be moving the DNA around. So you're growing Seminole pumpkins and I have some, and we trade some seeds, so we're just continually kind of adding vibrancy and life to our own seed supplies. This gets into complicated issues of seed saving. Seed saving could be as simple as growing tomatoes, saving a few ripe ones, squeezing out the seeds, rinsing them, drying them, and putting those dried seeds in the refrigerator for your next year's supply. Then you are independent of seed companies, and you have your own supply of tomatoes, you know, year after year into the indefinite future.
You'll be speaking here in Chattanooga on Thursday, July 24th. I just want to say really quickly, I get the idea you would probably be happy if people, particularly if maybe they're going to drive in from Atlanta or Cleveland or somewhere kind of far off, would carpool to this event rather than each one of them driving their own car.
I love this. What a great idea. In fact, we should offer prizes to the people, to the most people coming in one car. How about that?
How can people get more information about you and your books?
I would send them to online, of course, to I have a website, which is janiceray.weebly.com, and Janice is spelled J-A-N-I-S-S-E. But they could Google me. I have a Facebook page. But also just walk into to your library and see if any of the books are at the library.
Well, Janice Ray, thank you so much for talking with us. I'm looking forward to your talk here.
Mike, thank you very much for having me.
And again, Janice Ray will be here in Chattanooga on Thursday, July 24th at 7 p.m. She's going to be at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga in the University Center's Raccoon Mountain Room. Her talk is Sustainable Growing, Heirloom Seeds, and Protecting Our Pollinators. The Tennessee Valley Wild Ones are bringing her here. There is a charge. If you're a Tennessee Valley Wild Ones member, you get a discount. You can find more information and how to register and all that on the Tennessee Valley Wild Ones website, and that is TennesseeValley.WildOnes.org. Again, TennesseeValley.WildOnes.org. That's it for Around It About Chattanooga. Thank you all for listening. I am your host, Michael Edward Miller. If you have questions, comments, or story ideas, email me at mike-miller@utc.edu.